This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, The Secrets of Magic and Metaphysics, Book 1 of the Chronicles of Elmoran. And the author is Lynette Asmar, and Annette joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. This interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Lynette.
Hello, Steve. It's really nice to be here with you this evening, and I'm thrilled at the opportunity to be able to speak with you.
Well, great to have you with us all the way from Australia, and I'm always amazed at technology of how it sounds like you're right in the studio with us. But
I know, it's very clear.
Yes. Well, let me read a little bit what you've written just to set the stage for this very unique book. This is fiction, but it's based upon your personal experiences. You say this: I have written a metaphysical novel that contains much information that others might not want revealed to the general public. However, I feel it is time to release some of these secrets, and that's why I have written it as a fictional novel. I thought I could reach more people if I wrote it this way. However, the book is based on metaphysical fact. The book will benefit all types of people, whether they are only mildly interested in metaphysics or whether they consider themselves experienced in the physical arts. And so this is a classic fight between good and evil, and how one's unchecked emotions can cause jealousy, anger, and resentment. And also, of course, we have the dark forces are subtle in their manipulation of human beings. It sounds like a lot of things we go through in life in general, but we're dealing with the unseen world. Lynette, tell us about yourself. Let's start there. You have quite a story starting in your childhood.
I was rather an ill child. I wasn't actually expected to live, but I did make it. And because I was so ill, I was homeschooled for a lot of the time during my childhood. So I did spend quite a lot of time at home by myself. And during those times, I used to play with what I now know as elementals, which were fairies, gnomes, that type of thing. But I also used to see these tall light beings, which I now probably would call angels or intelligences. They didn't actually communicate with me so much. The smaller ones did, the fairy type beings did. But the tall ones used to come of an evening, and they would just watch over me, particularly if I was frightened or scared to go to sleep. And they stayed with me for quite some time, but when I eventually did go to school, I lost a lot of that. That seemed to go as I became more involved in the outer conscious world. And it probably wasn't till I was in my 20s again when I became aware of these otherworldly beings. And actually, it was when my husband passed over, probably about 21 years ago, but I took a writing course as therapy to help me cope with the grief. And this proved to be most interesting, as it really stimulated many unusual dreams and visionary experiences. And how it all started, I originally saw a cowled being standing at the foot of my bed reading from a scroll. I was woken up from sleep by a knocking in my head, and this was accompanied by flashing light. And so it woke me up and I saw this being. And I don't really remember what was said per se, but I did remember concepts or ideas. And I kept a journal of these experiences. And then bits and pieces of a story began to develop. And so I just kept making notes of what I saw, what I heard. And it was almost as if the book... Well, I didn't know it was going to be a book at that stage, but it was almost as if this book wrote itself. As I correlated these notes, I thought, Well, you know, I've been given all this guidance by these spiritual beings, and they've given me this information. I need to do something with it. And so eventually I did manage to compile it into the novel that I have today. Initially, I didn't have any romance in the book, but I let a friend read what I had written, and he just said straight out, oh, look, if you haven't got any romance in there, it's really not going to sell. People love romance.
Right.
So I turned around and had to introduce new characters into the book just to give it that extra flavor, which I'm pleased I did because it seemed to fit in very well.
But then
I put that manuscript away in one of my bottom drawers, and I forgot about it for about 10 years.
Huh.
But then one day I rediscovered it. And after reading it, I knew that I had something special because there was no way that, you know, that would have come out of my mind. Other beings had certainly helped me or channeled that information through. And so I give credit to those beings. It really wasn't me who wrote the book, but those wonderful beings who guided me.
You call yourself a teacher of meditation. You have a college of esoteric education, and I'm sure you have a website. We can learn more about that. What could you tell us that website right now?
The name of the site?
Yes.
Yes, it's esotericcollege.org.
Esotericcollege.org. And so if you'd like to learn more about what Lynette is doing with this college, you can go there and find out more details. But we want to focus on the book. Now, boy, there's so much here. I guess you talk about dark forces. You talk about angels, persons of light. Now, what exactly are the dark forces mentioned in the book?
Well, as we have a hierarchy of angels and beyond angels, we simply call them intelligences because we really don't know what else to call them. There's also a hierarchy of demonic beings. They also have their own system of barons, earls, knights, kings, princes, etc. And they don't really afflict too many ordinary people, but they do afflict people who are very, very negative or maybe psychopathic type of people. Those people who do, you know, things that we would consider horrendous. But the normal person does attract some of the lesser dark forces, and they will incite that person to continue doing whatever they're doing if they have a habit or, say, drinking, for instance, or drug taking. The dark force will incite the person to keep doing it because that's how they get their energy. And so they attach to the person's auric structure, sometimes even going in and completely possessing the person. Normally they'll just possess the person, which means they remain outside, not inside, but sometimes they do possess. And so some of these people will come to our college knowing that there is something not quite right, and so we'll have a look. And if they are afflicted, we will remove that force for them. And usually once we do that, they become interested in the meditation.
Right.
And so then we put them through the process of meditation, which is actually a channeled meditation from what we know as the Syrian Command.
Let's talk about some of these characters. Now, who would you say is the main character?
Well, look, they're all interesting. Dr. Michener is actually a Syrian being who has taken physical form to teach some of the secrets of magic and metaphysics. And he's really working on perfecting a portal to the fourth dimension in the form of this magic globe. And of course, he instructs his apprentices not to touch this globe. And then when he goes out of the room, of course, one of the young men, John Corner, simply can't resist, and he does put his hand inadvertently on that globe and gets sucked right through it and becomes a prisoner of a brother, Exeter, who is the evil sorcerer in the story. brother Exeter was once a white magician who, through greed and out of control ego, makes a contract with the Prince of Demons, who actually helps him in his organisation that he controls, and he helps him to become very wealthy. Brother Exeter is extremely power hungry and becomes, his ego gets so far out of control because he can't actually get what he wants from the apprentice that he's actually captured, and it frustrates him terribly. And so the story is about the other apprentice who was taken on a journey through the astral planes, some of the higher levels, but mostly down into the lower levels where the demonic forces exist. And he is accompanied by an Earth Zone intelligence, a Mookie. She is beyond the angelic realm.
This must be the romance.
I'm sorry?
Is this the romance?
Well, Michener advises him never to fall in love with one of these beings, that of course he can't resist himself because she's so beautiful. But no, there is other romance in that story as well. But that is part of learning control of the emotional body, when he is not to fall in love with one of these beings and he can't help himself. He knows he must overcome that. It's a very dangerous thing to do, and he actually does when she presents herself to him in her true form later on in the story, and he realizes that he's being taught by a super intelligence.
Now, what do you say to your skeptics? Well, how do you answer their questions?
Look, the only thing I can say to a skeptic is each one has their own opinion, and each one would look at metaphysics or look at the story and say maybe that's unbelievable. Well, the only thing I can say to them is, look, that's okay. You have your own opinion. You may not know a lot about metaphysics, and that's okay. But just enjoy the story. You will get something out of it because that information will go straight through to your subconscious mind and later on will come forward into consciousness, because that's how a lot of metaphysical teachings are actually taught. It's the words behind, or the energy behind those words, that actually stimulates people. Look, I think skepticism is very healthy because it makes you think, makes you stop, makes you look, well, you know, oh, that's a bit strange. But then, you know, sometimes it'll mull over in the brain and you can't let go of it. Mm-hmm. And it takes you, you know, somewhere deeper. And so you gain insight that you didn't have before.
Now, one of your messages, you talk about a lot of people on the planet are uncertain about the problem of fate or free will. So you're trying to help people understand those principles.
Yes, yes. This is so, look, if all our faculties were operating, that means our subtle faculties of clairvoyance, then that means the subtle sight where you see with the mind's eye, clairaudience, that's where you hear the voices of spirit. Clairsentience, that's where you can feel the energy running through your body. Claircognizance, that's where you have an inner knowing through the intuitive faculty. If we had all of those senses operating while we're down here on the earth plane, we would have to follow everything to the letter. We would have to walk that out. We would have no choice. But because we don't have all those faculties operating and we seem to stumble around here on the earth plane, we seem to have this free will. But ultimately, fate is our teacher, because as we're stumbling around, you know, things will happen to us and people say, well, why did that happen to me? It happens to them because it's a life lesson that they've actually set up themselves subconsciously by doing or being involved in something that perhaps they know they shouldn't be involved in, or subconsciously are doing things that their guides might think this person needs to go a different way, and so a lesson will be set up for them. So they have no choice but to go with what is being shown them. Or like a gross example may be a person who's out of control, not listening to the parents, going out late at night, doing silly things, all of a sudden has a car accident and is put out of action for a couple of months. That person would be given that time out to evaluate what they're doing, what their life is all about, hopefully.
Right.
So, you know, we are taught by fate until we reach a certain point and our faculties start to open. And then really it becomes not my will, O Lord, but thine be done through me. And that's the injunction we walk through when we're on a metaphysical path.
Well, Stanley, the apprentice of Dr. Michener, the master metaphysician, he, as you put it, will be forced to make a decision that will totally change his life and the lives of those he loves most dearly. And then you ask a couple questions. Will Stanley ultimately lose the woman he loves? Will all the hardships connected with reaching a new level of consciousness be worth the tremendous effort required to learn the secrets of magic and metaphysics?
Yes, that's right. On Stanley's journey through those lower planes, he learns a lot. He learns how to really overcome the emotional body and learn to walk those realms with compassion and dispassion at the appropriate time. However, he does have a girlfriend, Catherine, that he was involved with. But as he goes through, the experience he goes through, Catherine actually gets involved in another with another character in the book. And when Stanley actually comes back from that experience, he can actually see the love that exists between his former girlfriend and her new partner. And he wishes them all the best. He has no jealousy because he realizes those experiences have given him something that he couldn't have gained before. If he hadn't gone through that experience, he probably would have exhibited jealousy or, you know, not wanting to give the girl up. But because he went through that and he took initiation on that way through, he was able to do that and allow that beautiful young girl, you know, to have the life with the other person that she really loved. And Stanley will be going through further experiences in my second book, and he will also meet his true love in that second book, but not realize it at the time.
We've been listening to Lynette Asmar. She is the author of her book, The Secrets of Magic and Metaphysics, Book 1 of the Chronicles of El Myron. Lynette, tell us how to get your book.
Well, Steve, my book is available at Balboa Press or at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. You can also buy it through my college, College of Esoteric Education, and I've given you the website address. It's also on my blog. It's also on my Facebook, www.facebook.com/secrets.magic.metaphysics.
Well, thank you very much, Lynette, for being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you, Steve. It was a wonderful interview. Thank you so much for having me.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Balboa Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Get ready to live La Bella Vita with Dawn Catherine on Toginet.com. Live La Bella Vita. If you're wanting to know all the beauty tricks of the trade and the latest fashion trends before everyone else, this is your show. If you admire celebrities' beauty and their fashion sense, this is your show. Do you love wine and want to know more about the process it takes to make wine from the vine to the bottle? This is your show. Live La Bella Vita. For more on the show and your host, check out our website, labellavitacosmetico.com. This is the kind of show you can sink your teeth into. If you enjoy traveling and food and family, all with an Italian flair, then you can live La Bella Vita with your host, Dawn Catherine. Wednesday nights at midnight, 11 p.m. Central on toginet.com. Mark Lipinski is coming to TogiNet. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, a live two-hour show Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on TogiNet.com. Creative Mojo. It's fun, entertaining, informative, inspirational, and illuminating. Lipinski has worked on such shows as Oprah, The View, The Joan Rivers Show, and Ricky Lake. He's busy, but he's got the drive to share with Creative Mojo, dedicated to the modern crafter and crafting lifestyle. Dive into the info and enjoy everything from celebs to entertainment news to recipes, quilting and needlework, knitting, painting, woodworking, Christmas crafts, and so much more. This show boldly encourages you to discover and harness your own creative spirit by living creatively every day. For more on Mark and the show, check out marklipinski.com. Don't miss the fun. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, The Last Jeffersonian, Grover Cleveland and the Path to Restoring the Republic. And the author is Ryan S. Walters. And Ryan joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Westbow Press. Hello, Ryan.
Hi, Steve. I appreciate the invite.
Well, this is going to be an exciting look at the most, maybe for most forgotten, at least in the, let's see, when was Grover Cleveland president?
Well, he was actually president twice. Most people, you're right, they don't know him. They don't remember him. They don't remember him from history in school, but he's the only president to serve two non-consecutive terms. He was president from 1885 to 1889. He lost his bid for a second term, and he came back and won a second term, and he served from 1893 until 1897.
So right before Teddy Roosevelt.
Right before Roosevelt.
The big progressive.
McKinley succeeded
the start of
him, and then it was Roosevelt.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, the start of it all there. Well, at least a dominant part of the progressive movement under Teddy, but Grover Cleveland, you say this, he's largely unknown, as you just mentioned, one of our greatest conservative statesmen, and of course most of us know little about him, especially conservatives, and you often say he is the greatest conservative statesman you know nothing about. He was a solid Jeffersonian who would not budge from his beliefs. Boy, wouldn't that be great to have that today, someone who wouldn't budge?
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is to take a look at this guy and really examine his record and then put it up against what we're doing in government today. What is our government doing today? And it's night and day. The reason I titled the book The Last Jeffersonian is because Cleveland was the last president who adhered to Jeffersonian conservatism. Jeffersonian thought, going back to Thomas Jefferson. Now, that's not to say presidents after him didn't have some Jeffersonian qualities, because many of them did, but I'm talking about a pure advocacy of Jeffersonian conservatism. And what I mean by that is limited government, states' rights, low taxes and tariffs, economy and accountability in government, no national debt, adherence to sound money, individual responsibility, equal and exact justice for all, a strict construction of the Constitution, and a non-interventionist foreign policy. Those are sort of the basic tenets of Jeffersonian conservatism.
And he's
the last president who adhered to those beliefs.
And, of course, we hear that word so much today, conservatism, but you're going back to the roots, and most conservatives in the political arena today don't really fit that model as well as Grover Cleveland. And what, I mean, how do you look at today's political leaders, the candidates, especially our national ones, fitting the model of Grover Cleveland and Thomas Jefferson?
And that was that's one of the reasons I wrote the book. Obviously, I was concerned about the direction the country's going in. I think a lot of us are. But I was also concerned with the direction the conservative movement is taking. I mean, we have a lot of people calling themselves conservatives today that I don't think are really conservatives. That list I just read to you, I mean, when you put that up against what the Republican Party is doing, what they're advocating, look at George Bush's presidency. I don't think you can hardly look at any of those things and say that he advocated any of those things. we're just not doing. We've lost our sense of what conservatism is. And that's why I go back to the root. Where did it come from? Where did it start? It started with Thomas Jefferson and worked its way forward. Cleveland was the last one to advocate all of those things. And if you look at what happened during his time, look at what look at how our country went from really a joke in 1800 to the greatest power on the planet, and we did it with those types of ideals. Today we don't advocate those things, and look at what's happening. And that's what I'm saying. We're not pure anymore in our beliefs and our principles. We've gotten off track, and we're into all this notion that the government needs to help the individual and help the economy and intervene all over the world and wars and all of these things. And we've got to get back to our basic fundamental principles.
And we can learn from the past, and we can unfortunately repeat it if it's the kind of past that has a lot of problems with it, and that seems like what we're doing. But we can also learn from the past and do it right.
Absolutely. You got it exactly right. And that's kind of what I like to do as a historian, is to look back at the past. Because we've had the same problems we're dealing with today, we've dealt with in the past. And I'm just looking at how do we deal with them in Cleveland's time? Because when you look at what he dealt with, and you go through my book, I take each one of these problems, and it's just uncanny how the problems that we're dealing with today, he dealt with. And I look at how he dealt with them and how we're dealing with them. Case in point, we are in, and I've argued this point forever, we are in an economic depression. I mean, there's no recovery. This is a depression. This economy is depressed. I heard an economist yesterday said the same thing. We're in a depression. And how have we handled it today? We throw money at it. We spend and spend and spend and have these jobs bills and do all of these things to stimulate it and increase the money supply and all of these things that we do, and it hasn't done a thing except get us further in debt. How did they handle it in Cleveland's time? They left it alone. They let the free market correct itself. They cut taxes. They cut spending. They got the government out of the way. There was no such thing as a stimulus bill. Now, in his time, people were starting to say, well, maybe we do need to spend money. Maybe we do need to try to create jobs. And he said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to let the free market correct itself. And if we'd have done that in 2008, instead of going in there and start bailing people out, we'd be out of this mess. But it drags on and on and on because we're interfering with the natural laws of economics. Now, you say that today, they think you're crazy. Oh, you don't care. You're mean-spirited. But that's not – is it mean-spirited to put us $16 trillion in debt?
Yeah, that's that, – and unfortunately, most people don't really understand that. They don't understand the whole monetary system. They don't understand the impact of $16 trillion. And, of course, that's growing – at a rocket pace, yeah, by the second, mind-boggling how that is growing and how that can literally destroy us. So he, Grover Cleveland, understanding what he did about the principles of conservatism, that's amazing that he just got government out of the way. I mean, really got government out of the way.
Sure. These ideas of government paternalism.
Right.
And I have a chapter on government paternalism, which is the notion that the government is some sort of a father, and we're sort of his children, and they must take care of us.
Boy, we hear that today. We almost hear those kinds of words today, don't we?
And I've got some quotes in there from some of the politicians today, and that's the way they look at things. In other words, it really insults me when they say that, because they're telling me, and telling you, and telling all of us, well, you're too stupid to run your own life. We have to get in here and run it for you. No, you don't have to get in here and run it for me. And those ideals were coming more and more into the mainstream when he became president. Well, maybe we should do things. Maybe the government should intervene. And he dealt with those issues, and he was very, very strong about it. We're not going down the road of government paternalism, because he said, if we go down this road, if we start helping people in their everyday lives, the government handouts, he said, it'll never stop. People will become dependent on it. It'll destroy our moral fiber. And he was exactly right. And I talk about that in that chapter. Look at what we're spending in welfare today. Nearly $1 trillion. I mean, we're projected to spend over $10 trillion in anti-poverty programs in the next decade. That's ludicrous.
Well,
that's crazy.
Well, it's going to destroy the company. Yes, the country there will be. It always amazes me how people with the greatest intentions, and you know, we all want to help people, but you can't do it this way. It doesn't work. History proves that. You're the historian. You know that. Why do people think that they can always do it in a way that never worked before, but it'll work this time?
It's just the mindset of liberals. They have this unction to do good. I think it stems from a lot of things. I think it stems from they don't have any confidence in you and your abilities to do anything. They do think they're the smartest people in the room, and you're an idiot, and you can't run your own life. We need to make decisions for you. But Democrats get mad when you say this, but they're buying votes with that. I mean, everybody knows that. They want as many people dependent on the government so you'll keep voting to keep them in office. I mean, that notion has been around since Roman times. When people discover that they can vote themselves money out of the treasury, then the republic's over. Your rights are over. And that's what's happened. People know that. They know that they got all these goodies, and these programs are just endless. Welfare payments and food stamps and free telephones. It's just an enormous amount of programs.
And what's that
and
quote?
People want that.
What's that quote from Margaret Thatcher about socialism? You know, it only works until there's it always fails after there's no more money left to take from people. You know,
right.
I mean,
it socialism works until you run out of other people's money.
Man, run out of other people's money. Done. That's it. There you go. And that's where
we've run out of our money. Yep. We've run out of our children's money. Now we're running out of our grandchildren's money.
Well, and we keep borrowing it from other countries. I can't believe they even give us any more loans. I mean, but the power of the United States, I guess it's such a dominant force in the world that people, even other nations, leaders look at us and say, well, the United States will never fail, so our money's safe.
Sure, I mean, and people are still buying these treasury bills, but you hit on something. That day is coming if we don't stop. Even some foreign leaders in China and other places have said, you guys need to straighten up here a little bit. Mm-hmm. You're making us a little nervous.
Yeah.
And I think when they figure out we have no intentions of paying this back, I mean, what would we do today if China said, we're not loaning you any more money? We are sunk.
Well, and China could just say, okay, if we can't get paid in dollars or gold, we'll just take some of, you know, United States property.
Sure, and they're asking, and they're already asking for higher interest rates on these T-bills.
Sure.
Which is going to cause more problems.
Oh, yeah, that interest rate will devour our annual budget.
Well, look at this. Right now, interest rates are only about 2%. We're only spending about $240 or $50 billion a year on interest. Now, I say that. I mean, I know it sounds only $250 billion. But historically, that interest rate's about 6%. What if that interest rate goes up to 6%?
Mm.
We're $750. We got to come up with $750 billion a year just for interest. Yeah. Nearly $1 trillion that we're just going to throw. I mean, it's crazy. We've got to stop this now. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is to say we have got to put a stop to it and say no more spending, no more borrowing. Get our fiscal house in order.
Mm-hmm.
We can't do everything. We can't have a welfare state and a warfare state and handle this and pay for this and we can't do it all. We got to prioritize, and we don't seem to want to prioritize.
And of course, foreign affairs, what a out of control kind of part of the federal government today. We're just all over the place, and we're not consistent anywhere anymore.
I saw a commercial the other day for the United States Navy, and their new slogan is America's Navy, a global force for good.
Yeah.
That's not what our Navy was created for, or our Army, or any of our military.
Sure.
We're not a global force for anything, but that's what we look at it. We have troops, or some, at least in some degree, in over 100 countries now, over 900 bases and installations. I mean, we can't be the world's policeman anymore.
Well, we can't afford it. We never really could afford it. And all the money we give to countries, we give them grants all the time, no strings attached. We just can't, you know, with all the needs we have here. But I don't know how this works out. It's great to have people like you that are pointing these things out, because this isn't rocket science, is it?
No, it's not. And I'll tell you, that's where I get my most resistance from conservatives is foreign policy. A lot of conservatives like this interventionist foreign policy and wars, you know, perpetual war for perpetual peace and that kind of thing. And I mean, you said we need to pull out of Iraq and Afghanistan and watch them get mad at you. But when we went to war in the old days, we destroyed our enemies and came home. We didn't get in there and try to rebuild their country and pay to fix everything. You know, we bombed and that kind of thing. We dealt with our enemies and then we came home. We don't have contingents around the world. We didn't get involved in nation building and solving other people's internal problems. That's just not what our traditional foreign policy was. That goes back to Washington. We had a policy of neutrality. You know, we looked at Europe and said, you can get over there and fight amongst yourselves all you want to. We're not getting in it. And of course, that started soon after Cleveland left office with Woodrow Wilson, the First World War.
Mm-hmm. You
know, make the world safe for democracy. That's when we started steering off the path in foreign policy. Actually, it goes back to McKinley a little bit with the war, with the Spanish-American War in 1898. But it really got going with the World War One. And we've continued that same thing. And that's got to stop, too. Like you said, we can't afford it. But I also argue we don't need to be doing it even if we could afford it. Why? I don't understand why. We've lost a lot of good young men and women in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think that's going to be like Vietnam. I think we're going to look up one day and say, we've done nothing but throw lives and money away for no reason. We're trying to police a people that you can't police, just to be quite honest with you. And we're going to be in there decades more if we don't just cut our losses and get out. And people say, well, you're giving up on the war on terror. Well, no, I'm not. I think we've done all we can do over there.
We've been listening.
Our policy should be different. Our policy should be, look, we're going to deal with terrorist incidents in our country ruthlessly. We're going to deal with it ruthlessly. We're not going to go over there and put boots on the ground and try to bring democracy to Afghanistan. That's crazy.
Right.
It's crazy.
Yeah, they're a nation of tribes. That's impossible to do that.
That's been there for thousands of years. And you say things like, well, they don't want democracy. And people get upset and offended and say, well, anybody would want democracy. Now, if they've been there thousands of years, don't even know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interior. And I've done some world travel. I love to travel around the world. And you get into different cultures, things don't mean the same. You could say democracy and freedom. They don't have a concept of what you mean. Go to Vietnam and talk about private property and see what they talk to you. They don't understand it,
mm-hmm.
the concept of it. And so we're trying to take our values and push them off on somebody else. I just think that's a dangerous thing to do. We shouldn't be doing. That's not what our – we don't have a mission to do that. We don't have a mission to take our young men and women and say, okay, we're going to enforce democracy. So what? If they want our help or something, that's different, but not to do it by force. We should destroy our enemies and let them handle their country.
We've been listening to Ryan S. Walters. He is the author of his book, The Last Jeffersonian, Grover Cleveland and the Path to Restoring the Republic. Ryan, tell us how to get your book.
It's available on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble. You can get it online. You can go to my site. I have a blog site, RyanSWalters.net. You can get it from there. And I'm a local columnist here in South Mississippi, so I put my columns on that site, and you can get all the information there. You can get it from Westbow Press directly. So I'm all over the internet. You can get it anyway. If you want it signed, I'll be happy to sign it.
Well, thank you, Ryan, for being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you, Steve. I really enjoyed it. It's been a lot of fun.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Westbow Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Get ready to laugh along with This Little Parent Stayed Home with Ali Lopreet. Friday evenings at 6, 5 Central on TogiNet.com. This is a truly realistic, no-nonsense, tell-it-like-it-is method that will have you laughing and crying, surviving while struggling, and hammering away at the hardships as you travel through the greatest journey of your life. Get empowered by joining thousands of other parents who have also decided to take a leap of faith into a double career with longer hours and half the pay simply because of the love they have for their children. Together, we are rebuilding a new economy that will support us rather than enslave us. Never again will we have to choose between raising our children and earning to provide for them. It won't be easy, but it will be worth it. For more on Allie and her success, check out her website, OurMilkMoney.com. So come get empowered with This Little Parent Stayed Home with Allie Lopreet,
Friday afternoons at 6, 5 Central, on TogiNet.com.
People think I've made it. I'm popular. I seem happy all the time. I have great clothes and I'm involved in everything. But I have questions, doubts, and fears, just like every other teenager. That's why I'm glad for Teen Talk Radio, where it's all about choices.
Join us for Teen Talk Radio with Nicole O'Dell, Thursday nights at 10, 9 Central on TogiNet.com.
The choices we have to make that can alter the course of our lives. Life is too much pressure if we try to go it alone. I tune in to Teen Talk Radio with Nicole O'Dell every week to get reminded that I'm not alone. Nicole O'Dell is an expert on what happens in the lives of teenagers. Join her as she deals with topics like peer pressure, purity, drugs, alcohol, and many other things that might come up along the way. She writes books and speaks to people all over the place, but she says her favorite moments are when she can pull up a chair and chat with teens about what's important to us.
For more information on Nicole and her books, go to NicoleOdell.com. Then join us for Teen Talk Radio with Nicole O'Dell, Thursday nights at 10, 9 Central on TogiNet.com.
Teen Talk Radio, where it's all about choices.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, The Flowering House, Awakening to Your Heart's Desire. And the author is Paige Sterling Fox, and Paige joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. This interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Paige.
Hello, Steve.
This journey of the flowering house, it's a transformation story. It's very, very unique, aimed at women, though I'm sure men can get a lot out of it as well. But let me just read what you've written about it, and then we're going to find out how you created this and what are the different principles in here, because it's obviously a metaphor, this book about life. In the flowering house, Camilla keeps a perfect facade, but lives with the hidden truth of sealed-off rooms in a trashy backyard, until the day she hears a ringing behind a closed door and courageously chooses to enter. The transformation that follows reveals all that is possible when we listen to our hearts. Well, that's really well put. I like that. That kind of very, very, very well sums up this intriguing story. Tell us about yourself, Paige, and how all this came about.
Yes, well, Steve, about 10 years ago, I went through a major life transformation of my own, a transition where I'd left my first marriage that was quite unhappy. And I also left a six-figure, high-powered job that I was also unhappy in and didn't know where I was going to land, but just trusted that it would end up better than where I was at the time. And it was shortly after that, after I began to process that transition in my life and became clear about where I was headed, that this initial story of the flowering house came through to me. And I wrote it all down and didn't know what to do with it at the time. You know, I thought maybe it was a children's story because it was quite short and it was simple little tale. And yet I had all these deeper meanings that came clear out of the book. And so not knowing where to go with it and not really having a dream of publishing at that time, I put it away and my life evolved. I got married again and had two children, became a life coach and began facilitating programs for women, especially healing programs and spiritual and personal growth programs and workshops. So I began to hear these stories from women about their own transitions, their own transformations through life. And then about 2 years ago, I lost my mom. And after her passing, I felt a very strong urging to take this little story out of the drawer. And when I did, it all became very clear to me. I reread the story and I realized this is not just my story from 10 years previous, but it was the story of so many women who perhaps leave their own dreams unattended while they attend to their daily responsibilities, or perhaps they just begin to lose their essence within, you know, the wrong relationship or the wrong job or whatever. So I saw that what was needed with the story was a companion kind of workbook or journal piece. And now I had 10 years of experience of working with women. I had the tools available to really build that part of the book. So this lovely story of Camilla is followed by the lessons from the story in a way that each woman can journal about what her life is revealing to her, what wisdom lies within her own experience, and work through what dreams she may be wanting to express now in her life.
One of the messages is put this way. You write, "Sometimes our dreams are waiting for us, and we need simply be willing to open the door to move toward them." So that's what this, it's such a metaphor. Of course, this door in Camilla's house with the beautiful front yard and the beautiful living room and the trashy backyard and the trashy closets and all that. But this, well, tell us about that room, that the ringing behind the door. What was that about?
So I think we all have a room within ourselves like this. For Camilla, it's a room that's been closed off for many, many years. She hasn't been in there. She doesn't think she needs anything in the room, and she's kind of scared to go in there because it might be overwhelming, the mess and the the built-up dust and boxes that she hasn't looked at for years and years. And it's only when she hears this ringing, and for quite some time she ignores the ringing, as often we do. The whispers are there, but we don't listen to them, and then they get louder, and they get louder. And so Camilla finally chooses to enter. And that's, a metaphor for all those times we summon our courage to walk through a door that we have no idea what lies on the other side. And as you have mentioned before, sometimes that is scary because it could take a lot of work, and it does for Camilla and it does for most of us, to not only just walk through the door. It's often not sunshine and roses on the other side. There are things that need to be dusted off, things that need to be unearthed, and that takes a little bit of doing. So, encourage women to do is to slow down long enough to hear the whispers, to hear that ringing bell, because there is something there wanting to be expressed in her life, and there are treasures to be found in that room.
So don't be afraid to go through the door.
That's right. Although it sometimes takes us time to summon the courage, and timing is everything. So it's not as though we're on the wrong path. It's often just a matter of timing, as it was for me in writing this story. I couldn't have written it the way that it is now 10 years ago. So it needed to live in its drawer for a while until I had the skills and experience and deepened kind of own personal growth to be able to bring what I brought to the story. And that's true for many of us. It's a matter of timing, but we do know, sometimes life hits us upside the head and forces us through the door. We get fired. We lose someone precious to us. A relationship breaks up, etc. And often it is these kind of, really pivotal life moments that force us through the door. Illness is another one. I work with a lot of women who have journeyed through cancer. And I work at a local cancer support center, and they say that, upon reflection, that illness was a gift to them because it helped them to slow down and get to the core of what is the truth for them, what is essential for them. So we need not have to be hit upside the head by what I call the cosmic 2x4. We can take this into our own hands, but we need to slow down and kind of dim the noise of our daily lives in whatever way that works, whether it's getting out for a walk in nature or whether it's taking a daily bath, whether it's learning to meditate. Somehow we need to get quiet and still in order for us to hear those little whispers.
You also say this, the journey of self-reflection, which you've been talking about, and discovery can be a tricky one to navigate on your own.
Mm. Absolutely. I think, we are very externally focused. Life is very demanding right now. For people, there are so many demands on them, responsibilities on them with their families, their work lives, their friendships, their responsibilities, their finances, all of that. That it can be really scary and maybe even just seem quite impossible to know how to slow down and how to pause. In the book, Camilla has to call in some friends to unearth the really big weeds in her backyard. And I say, this is true for all of us. There are big weeds. There are some wounds, perhaps, or some experiences that need to be processed. And it is something that can be done better in a circle, with a professional, with a group of friends. We don't have to do this work on our own.
Besides this fictional symbolic story, you also include a journal section. And why did you do that?
Well, it's my belief, Steve, that our lives have inherent wisdom. And there are a lot of books out there, if you go to the self-help section, that will tell you the way to get a better life, to get happy, to improve yourself. But I believe that most of the wisdom that we need is already reflected in our own life. And so I wanted to provide, instead of a how-to guide, I wanted to provide a sort of mirror for the reader. And to me, that happens best through writing, through journaling, through questions that are answered. It may not be done in writing. Some people prefer to speak out loud, and they may form a group of like-minded individuals to kind of go through the book together and speak about or have a discussion about the topics in each of the journal sections. And then there's also, besides the questions, a suggested activity or a suggested kind of direction or exercise to do, and that comes from my coaching background, so that people can take it a little step further and really begin to implement these things in their own life. I could see someone really doing, you know, one of these chapters, and a chapter is just really a couple pages, over an entire week, so that it may become a 24-week kind of process for someone.
And you also have beautiful symbolic art throughout the book.
Yes, this is the real gift, I feel. You know, I've had the book out now for just over a month, and women who are buying it tend to take a quick look through, see the pictures, and then they take the book and hold it against their chest, kind of their heart space, lovingly holding it, saying, I'm going to take this into my garden, or I'm going to do this on Saturday morning before my kids are awake. And I think, honestly, it's because the pictures, the artwork done by Lena Ralston, who is a very gifted artist, they convey the love and the compassion that are contained within the story as well. Because Lena is a symbolic artist, she was a perfect fit for the story, which is also a metaphor.
What would you say was the most challenging part about writing your book?
You know, there wasn't a whole lot of challenge, I have to say, mostly because I set out with the intent that it bring joy and ease into my life, because my life is already full. I have a full-time job and two young children and volunteer work and all the rest. So I knew it couldn't be something that was going to be a struggle. And quite honestly, it was really a joy in its expression. And the only thing, I guess, that's important to me as I've been walking through the writing and publishing and now promotion of the book is that I stay balanced, because that's my whole message of the book. So I really I'm attending to the fact that I want to take good care of myself along with all the other things that I'm doing in my life.
Do you see your book part of this awakening in people? There's so many demands, and we just really have to awaken to our spiritual needs, you know, and our emotional
Absolutely.
Needs, and whatever it is that's dominant in our life, the need.
Absolutely, Steve. I think that this is a time of awakening. This is a time of great opportunity. This is a spiritual book, and it is meant to be kind of a companion and that guide of spiritual awakening. But some people are intimidated by those words, even. They don't understand what that means. So to me, you know, there's an easier way to present it, which is just, you know, this is a book that allows you to take time for yourself, to reflect, to look within, and anybody can hear that message because they know they're too busy and they know they need to take time within. to me, the very first step on our spiritual path is to love ourselves, to listen to our inner voice, and to feel that we are worthy of having joy and connection and creativity and love. So to me, anything that cultivates that, and I believe the Flowering House does, is a tremendous first step. For those who are already on a spiritual path, they will already resonate with a lot of the messages in the book, and then they can deepen their own spirituality by taking a look through the messages of the story.
We've been listening to Paige Sterling Fox. She is the author of her book, The Flowering House, Awakening to Your Heart's Desire. Paige, tell us how to get your book.
Well, Steve, it's available on most major online booksellers, you know, Amazon and Barnes & Noble, etc. It's available through Balboa Press, which is my publisher. And people can also take a look on my website to link directly to Balboa. My website is www.thefloweringhouse.com.
Thank you so much, Paige, for being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you for having me, Steve. It was a pleasure.
And this interview has been brought to everyone by Balboa Press.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.